This is Stephanie Rubel from the Stanford Alumni Association. I'd like to welcome you to our final book of the 2012-2013 Book Salon season, The Great Gatsby. This month, I'm delighted to introduce our May host, Professor Gavin Jones. Professor Jones teaches courses on 19th and 20th century American literature and is the author of Strange Talk, The Politics of Dialect Literature in Gilded Age America, and American Hungers, The Problem of Poverty in U.S. Literature, 1840 through 1945. He is also the editor of a recent scholarly edition of Sylvester Judd's neglected transcendental novel, Margaret, A Tale of the Real and Ideal Blight and Bloom. He has published articles in journals such as American Literary History, New England Quarterly, and African American Review, and is currently completing a book about American literature's obsessive efforts to describe and theorize the experience of failure. Gavin, thank you so much for kicking off this month's discussion.
My pleasure. It's very good to be here.
Great. So can you please tell our readers why you chose this book?
Right. Well, that's an easy one. It's the great American novel, in my opinion. The term great American novel was really popularized after the Civil War, and there was a kind of call for a novel which could embody the diversity of experience in the United States in this rich, multifarious culture. And in a way, I think The Great Gatsby comes closest to doing that. It gives a particular kind of experience. It's very narrowly about a particular social class in the 1920s, but it really gets at what I think are some of the fundamental contradictions of American life. So you have this story of really an exuberant, sort of spectacular kind of success, which is embodied in the figure of Jay Gatsby. But it's a success it's really identical to the worst kind of failure, all of the moral hypocrisy and corruption, which sort of underpins this vision of gorgeousness, which is Gatsby. So I think it's a really unique book in the sort of the intensity of its description of the contradictions of American life. That is, it's both a celebration and a condemnation of the American dream and the idea and the ideal of self-making. So that's really, you know, why I selected it. It's also a book that's always appealed to me very much. When I was sort of 16 and 17, I would just incessantly read American literature, as you can probably tell from my accent. I'm a Brit. So this was really one of the first books that really got me attracted to American literature in general.
I think it's going to be really enjoyable for our alumni to read this along with you. So can you single out what issues our readers might find interesting to discuss?
Yeah, sure. I can do that. I'll also say a few words about what brought the book into being for Fitzgerald. You know, it's a book that's defined by contradictions of authorship as well. It's a sort of accidental success in a way. I mean, it wasn't initially a success when it was first published. It took a few years for it really to take hold in the American imagination. So it was a book written when Fitzgerald was very anxious about his own creativity. I mean, he felt he'd had early success with his novel of undergraduate life in Princeton, This Side of Paradise. And then he became really a sort of a nervous, anxious individual who felt that really he'd used up all of his literary material and that he had nothing left. And his relationship with Zelda was always very fragile. So it was a novel that was written from a profound lack of confidence on Fitzgerald's part. But it's also an amazingly confident novel in that it's so brief, it's so succinct. It is that great American novel, but it's so intense in the way that it describes that experience. I mean, it's one of those books that's actually a lot longer than you think it is. You know, it's, what, 120 pages. So, you know, that's something that intrigues me. You know, can the readers find moments that reveal Fitzgerald's own anxieties about authorship? I mean, it's such a confident masterpiece, really, but are there places where those anxieties show through? And there are a number of other issues that I think readers might find interesting. The first one is the figure of the narrator, Nick Carraway. He's a really fascinating figure. This is a really fascinating study of point of view, unreliable narration. So, you know, Nick, early on in the novel, describes himself as, you know, an honest person, a reliable person, a normal person, which I think flags really a whole network of issues and problems that seep out in his own narrative voice and from his own perspective. How and why does he construct this myth of Gatsby? Why is he so obsessed with Gatsby? What does he include in the novel? What does he leave out? There's this wonderful scene towards the end where some kids have scrawled an obscenity on the doorstep of Gatsby's mansion, and Nick just, you know, takes his shoe and scrapes out this word. We never know what's written there. Why don't we know? I mean, who is making, and why is Nick making these decisions about inclusion and exclusion? So, you know, think about the theme of vision, the theme of point of view, who's telling this tale, and at what points do the telling of the tale actually outweigh what's being told, where we really, you know, Nick Carraway, a caraway is a very mild flavor that comes from a seed. I mean, it's a seed that gives a mild flavor, but you have to ask, you know, how mild is the flavor that Nick Carraway gives to this novel? I mean, he is very manipulative and he's kind of controlling our vision for certain ends. So, you know, keep your eye on perspective in this book. Remember, there's the wonderful description of the eyes of T.J. Eckelberg just sort of shining out over the wasteland at the beginning of chapter two. And I think that we're directed to think about vision in general, the theme of vision, and also the structure of what's being seen and how it's being seen. Another thing to keep an eye on, I think, is the elusiveness of this book. I mean, it seems so kind of carelessly written, so effortlessly written, but it is a very self-conscious novel with a great deal of sort of literary allusion within it to T.S. Eliot's The Wasteland, to Benjamin Franklin's autobiography. It's a very self-conscious book. It's part of its moment, you know, the early 1920s. It's part of the world of high modernism. I mean, it is a description of the American dream and American culture, but it's also part of that high modernist literary culture as well at the time. It's a book that writes itself into a particular kind of literary tradition through its self-consciousness. So I'd like readers to keep an eye out for those allusions and see if they can kind of spot which texts are referred to by Fitzgerald and why are they referred to in that way. For example, there are some pretty clever references to John Keats's Ode to a Nightingale. See if readers can pick up on that. It's also a book that deals with some of the fundamental themes that run throughout American literature, the concern with race, with whiteness, what makes people racially white, the vulnerability of whiteness in this new multicultural society, the relationship between self-making and inheritance. I mean, that's another great theme of American literature, and it's one that's very central to this book as well. I'd also like readers to keep an eye out for moments where the book doesn't seem to make sense. There are moments which signal a peculiar kind of ambiguity or failure. For example, look at the end of chapter two. Chapter two is this, I mean, I think one of the finest chapters in all of American literature that begins on Long Island, ends up in Manhattan in this scene of trauma and violence at the end of chapter two. And then it also ends with this strange hallucination in which Nick Carraway seems to be basically in bed with a male photographer. I mean, it's a very odd scene and it's never fully made sense to me. And so I want readers to really think about that, the end of chapter two, and think about whether there are other scenes that don't quite hang together and why don't they hang together. And then finally, think about the theme of time. You can think of Fitzgerald, I think, as a kind of late romantic writer. And I'm thinking of English romanticism of the late 18th, early 19th century, the way that the romantics were obsessed with time and trying to understand memory and the relationship between the past, the present, and the future. So it's very much a novel about how time passes, how certain things get remembered. So that's another, I think, good theme to guide a reader through the book, to think about this novel as, sure, a novel about American culture, but it's also a book about time. So I think that could be helpful.
I think our alumni are really going to enjoy discussing this book. So I know you brought a passage to share with us.
Yes.
So if you could go ahead and read it to for us, and also let us know why you chose it.
I will. And you'll have to believe me that everybody spoke with British accents in the 1920s on Long Island. Okay. This is one of my favourite themes, rather passages, in the book. And this is the first time... this is in chapter 4. So it's a few pages into chapter 4. And Nick Carraway has met Gatsby a couple of times, but he doesn't know him well. And this is the first time that they really start to talk and get to know each other a little bit. And so Gatsby offers to take Nick out for a spin in his car. He's got this wonderfully colourful automobile. And so they go out for a spin. And then there's a certain point during this jaunt in which Jay Gatsby suddenly breaks out and starts talking to Nick and looking at Nick in a very intense way. "Look here, old sport," he broke out surprisingly. "What's your opinion of me anyhow?" A little overwhelmed, I began the generalised evasions which that question deserves. "Well, I'm going to tell you something about my life," he interrupted. "I don't want you to get a wrong idea of me from all these stories you hear." So he was aware of the bizarre accusations that flavoured conversation in his halls. "I'll tell you God's truth." His right hand suddenly ordered divine retribution to stand by. "I am the son of some wealthy people in the Middle West, all dead now. I was brought up in America, but educated at Oxford, because all my ancestors have been educated there for many years. It is a family tradition." He looked at me sideways, and I knew why Jordan Baker had believed he was lying. He hurried the phrase, "educated at Oxford," or swallowed it, or choked on it, as though it had bothered him before. And with this doubt, his whole statement fell to pieces, and I wondered if there wasn't something a little sinister about him after all. "What part of the Middle West?" I inquired casually. "San Francisco." "I see. My family all died and I came into a good deal of money." His voice was solemn, as if the memory of that sudden extinction of a clan still haunted him. For a moment I suspected that he was pulling my leg, but a glance at him convinced me otherwise. "After that I lived like a young Raja in all the capitals of Europe, Paris, Venice, Rome, collecting jewels, chiefly rubies, hunting big game, painting a little, things for myself only, and trying to forget something very sad that had happened to me a long time ago." With an effort, I managed to restrain my incredulous laughter. The very phrases were worn so threadbare that they evoked no image except that of a turbaned character leaking sawdust at every pore as he pursued a tiger through the Bois de Boulogne. "Then came the war, old sport. It was a great relief, and I tried very hard to die, but I seemed to bear an enchanted life. I accepted a commission as first lieutenant when it began. In the Argonne Forest, I took two machine gun detachments so far forward that there was a half-mile gap on either side of us where the infantry couldn't advance. We stayed there 2 days and two nights, 130 men with 16 Lewis guns, and when the infantry came up at last, they found the insignia of three German divisions among the piles of the dead. I was promoted to be a major, and every Allied government gave me a decoration. Even Montenegro, little Montenegro down on the Adriatic Sea." Little Montenegro. He lifted up the words and nodded at them with his smile. The smile comprehended Montenegro's troubled history and sympathised with the brave struggles of the Montenegrin people. It appreciated fully the chain of national circumstances which had elicited this tribute from Montenegro's warm little heart. My incredulity was submerged in fascination now. It was like skimming hastily through a dozen magazines. He reached into his pocket and a piece of metal slung on a ribbon fell into my palm. "That's the one from Montenegro." To my astonishment, the thing had an authentic look. "Oderi di Danilo," ran the circular legend, "Montenegro, Nicholas Rex." "Turn it." "Major J. Gatsby," I read, "for valour extraordinary." "Here's another thing I always carry, a souvenir of Oxford days. It was taken in Trinity Quad. The man on my left is now the Earl of Doncaster." It was a photograph of half a dozen young men in blazers loafing in an archway through which were visible a host of spires. There was Gatsby, looking a little, not much, younger, with a cricket bat in his hand. Then it was all true. I saw the skins of tigers flaming in his palace on the Grand Canal. I saw him opening a chest of rubies to ease with their crimson-lighted depths the gnawings of his broken heart. So I'll leave it there. Maybe I could just say a word or two about why this is one of my favourite passages. And also to say what I think are the two most important words in this whole novel. Remember that little bit where Nick says, you know, what part of the Middle West does Gatsby's family come from? And Gatsby replies, San Francisco. And Nick says, I see. And he does finally come to see in this scene at the end where he says, then it was all true. You know, I saw the skins of tigers flaming in his palace on the Grand Canal. So he's been told all of these barefaced, constructed lies in which Gatsby doesn't even know that San Francisco isn't in the Middle West, doesn't know that Venice is not a capital city of Europe. He's sort of sold this this kind of fakery, which is also true. You know, there is something authentic to this medal that Gatsby gets. There does seem to be something authentic to his experience in Oxford. There's this eye to authenticity that Gatsby has. He's holding a cricket bat, you know, just as he, you know, presents his shirts to Daisy at a certain point in the novel, and they've all got this monogram of J. Gatsby on them. There's an eye to detail. And so he's really made himself, and it's a real self, but it also has all of the rough edges and the sign of the constructedness of that self. But despite all of the fabrication, Nick comes to see and comes to believe in this vision. In a way, Nick comes to believe in the gorgeousness of Gatsby, you know, not despite but because of the kind of the fakery and the constructedness of it. There's something gorgeous in Gatsby that is gorgeous almost because it's fake. And so this is a scene that really gets us to think about why Nick needs Gatsby. It gets us to think about why Nick has this need for something in his own life, for some kind of romance, for some symbol of almost religious gorgeousness. There's also something, I guess, sort of Catholic in Gatsby, in a kind of, you know, you think of the gorgeousness of the Roman Catholic religion, and there's that kind of sense of symbolic gorgeousness around Gatsby as a character. And Nick needs him. You know, he's living in this godless universe in which, you know, God is dead, civilization is going to pieces, and all there is sort of J. Gatsby standing alone, this symbol of splendor, you know, within a kind of a almost nihilistic universe. And this passage, I think, is full of suggestion in that regard. And it's also a great illustration of how Fitzgerald uses conversation between characters and what seem to be throwaway words, like just those two words, I see. You know, this is a book all about vision. It's about how Nick comes to see Gatsby in a certain way. It's a book about his point of view. And Fitzgerald has the real efficiency of craft to just embody the whole thematic of this book in those two very simple words.
Great. Thank you so much for sharing that with us.
My pleasure.
Thank you for introducing us to The Great Gatsby.
Okay, and I hope your readers and our alumni have a great time with this. I'm looking forward to observing the discussion.